guys, do you like video games? Do you like heavy metal, comic books, movies, theme parks, or even cool TV shows? We've got the place for you. Time to rock out with your geek out. Metal Geeks! Welcome, Geekazoids. Here are your hosts, Carrie G and John Michael. Geek it out, fellas!
Welcome, everyone, to episode 41 of the Metal Geeks Podcast. I am one of your hosts. I am Carrie G.
And I am JM Metal Geek.
We have a very different show for you this week. We have a Disney-fied geekery show. We have with us an author and a filmmaker, both working on a project right now called The Dark Side of Disney. Please welcome to the show, Philip Swift and Leonard Kinsey.
Hey, guys.
Hey, how's it going?
I guess if you can say, hey, I'm Leonard.
Oh, yeah,
and
I'm
Philip.
That would help. I'm Philip. This is the dulcet tones of Philip Swift.
Hey, this is Leonard Kinsey.
All right, thank you guys. So we have lots of Disney stuff that I wanted to talk to you guys about, but you guys are working on this documentary about. But let's start from the beginning. You wrote a book, Leonard, called The Dark Side of Disney, which I've been reading, and it's the book I would have written if you hadn't done it already. It's great. It's not your typical Disney guidebook.
No, definitely not. And that's the reason I wrote it, because there wasn't anything else like it out there. And, you know, really all the guidebooks out there are kind of for soccer moms and their kids. And that's not me. So, I wrote the guidebook that described how I like to do Disney, which is, you know, drinking and getting into trouble kind of and all the fun adult stuff that, you know, that adults like to do.
If you're looking for your Disney guidebook with cursing in it, look no further.
There's definitely plenty of cursing in there.
So what made you sit down one day and go, I'm gonna write my own guidebook, and I don't care who reads it, but I want to write it for myself.
I've been writing I call them tip sheets for people. Like I'd find out they were going on a Disney trip, and you know, I'd send them this document with all these tips that I'd come up with over the years. And so I was born and raised in Florida, so I just went to Disney all the time. So I'd already kind of had this big list of tips that I'd give people, and people would come back and be like, oh, that, you know, this tip was awesome. This tip saved me so much money. This tip kept me from getting scammed. It was between that, and I also had all these stories from when I went there and went down, you know, into the underground and the Utilidors, and you know, went brought dates there and did various things. So I'd tell people these stories, and they're just always fascinated by them, I guess, because you know, most people don't think of sex, drugs, and rock and roll when they think of Disney. So it was kind of a combination of those two things, just already having a lot of those tips and knowing how excited people were. And then, like I said, just not having a travel guide out there for someone like me, I just kind of wrote it for myself, really. And it turns out that there are a lot of other people like me out there, which is awesome.
Yeah, man, there's totally. I mean, you go to Disney and, especially when I go, you know when another metalhead is there. You know when you're like, oh, it's like this unspoken bond. You're like, hey, man, what's up? It's like, okay, we're two different guys at Disney, and, you know, everybody else, like you said, is soccer moms around you and we start dragging their kids around, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And you know, there's actually, you know, a lot of really good music there that's not like when you think of Disney music, you think, mm-hmm. you know, just the stuff in the cartoons, it's almost like Broadway stuff. But, you know, they have the Food and Wine Festival, they got the Flower and Garden Festival, they bring in some really good bands for those. And then you've got the people like the British Invasion, who play the 60s hard rock stuff, and you've got the guys over in I'm blanking on the name now, but they play like the Scottish kind of rock music.
Off kilter.
Yeah. They're really excellent musicians. So yeah. I mean, if you want to see good music there, you definitely can.
And John Michael here just got their passes for the year. They live not like about an hour away, which makes me fucking jealous every time I think about it. But yeah, listen to these guys, JM. I mean, there's especially like Epcot and stuff, like, you know, just go and hang out and listen to some of the music and just drink some beer and have a good time.
Well, it was interesting. Exactly. Actually, the first time we ever used our passes, I think we were over in the UK, and we were sitting behind a building. I think it was the Twining's Tea area, and there's a little pavilion in the back.
Yep.
And we sat down on these benches, and there was a woman from Tampa. She just started talking to me and my wife, and she actually drove all the way out to Tampa to just watch a band play.
Yeah.
And I think that was the band that plays the Beatles.
Yeah, the British Invasion. Man, I've seen some crazy stuff. Like, toward the end of the night, they do like three or four sets a night, and by the last set, like, I've seen women, like, so drunk, getting up on that stage with them and, like, trying to, like, make out with them and stuff. It's, like, it gets pretty great there. I mean, it's entertaining for me anyway.
Just because you're at Disney doesn't mean alcohol doesn't have the same effects on you.
Oh, no, definitely not. So, yeah, that band definitely has some groupies. It's pretty funny. It's definitely
awesome.
Interesting phenomena. Yeah.
So where else in the four parks, do you cover Disneyland at all in this?
I don't cover Disneyland in that. And, you know, when I wrote the book, I'd only been to Disneyland, you know, maybe once or twice. So I wasn't very familiar with it.
Spoiled the sequel, have I?
Well, no. You know, it's weird because I still don't feel like I know Disneyland well enough to write a book like this about it. I mean, that Dark Side Disney was kind of a lifetime of research. Disneyland still confuses me a bit. I love it, but, you know, and it's different. There's no underground tunnels.
Right.
And kind of the interesting thing about Walt Disney World is it's this space where there's nothing outside of it. Like, it brings you into this separate world. So this separate, clean kind of, you know, fairy tale world. And so when you find gritty, dirty reality, inside of that, it's very interesting to me. Whereas Disneyland, it's like you walk 2 feet and you're in, you know, Anaheim with a bunch of hobos and stuff walking around. And
speaking of dirty and gritty,
yeah. So it's,
right outside the gate.
Yep. So it's not quite as interesting to me because I don't know. It seems like it's a lot easier to see the dark side of Disneyland than it is to see the dark side of Walt Disney World.
And I'll be going back to Disneyland in, I think, about 3 weeks now. So I went last year, and then it was like 10 years between trips. So
yeah, I love
it. It's totally changed.
Yeah, it's super nice. I mean, I prefer Disneyland over Magic Kingdom any day of the week. So
I would agree on that one.
Yeah,
not to sound cheesy and all that kind of stuff, but people always say it, but it feels magical there. You know, you feel different. It's not, you don't feel like it's like just a cookie cutter version of it.
Yeah. It's very, it's almost quaint. Like, and it seems like everyone's happy, and maybe it's not, they don't try to like pry money from my fingers every second, like they seem to in Magic Kingdom. I mean, I know they're trying, but maybe they're just not as blatant about it.
Yeah. A little more subtle there.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about some of the parks. What is there for somebody that's not a soccer mom to do in some of the other parks around?
Well, you know, the funny thing is Magic Kingdom up until recently was the only park that was a dry park where you couldn't get booze. Now they have the Be Our Guest restaurant where you can order some expensive wine or beer. But, you know, all four parks have some really great places to drink, some great bars. So, you know, you could just go and kind of sample drinks and food all day at any of the parks. And one of the things that I always stress to people is you don't even have to go into a park to have a good time at Walt Disney World, because they're all the resorts, all the hotels, all have free stuff that you can do. They're all really well themed. You know, there's boat rides you can take for free. Nice walking trails through nature, and again, some really amazingly well-themed bars. And you could ride the monorail, all sorts of things. So, there's no end of adult activities over in Walt Disney World.
My boss went a couple of years ago with his family. They were just in Florida, and they did all the free. They were asking me, "What kind of free stuff can I do without paying to get into the park?"
Mm-hmm.
And you know, like everything you said, Downtown Disney, you know, going to different, you know, different hotels and just looking around and just being amazed.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, you can, you're not supposed to, but they've, all the hotels have these heavily themed pool areas where you can go mm-hmm. and swim in their pool, nice pools. And that to me is fun, you know, just lounging by the pool with a cocktail and, just chilling out, and that doesn't cost you a cent. So yeah, definitely.
I think the first time, like I said, at Epcot, me and my wife literally spent $20. That's it.
That's awesome. Yeah.
And it was because she wanted a drink in Paris,
yeah.
and she wanted a drink in Norway.
Yeah.
So. Wait to go to Food and Wine this year, JM. You're going to have a blast.
Oh, yeah.
My coworkers have been telling me about that, and I'm not very familiar with it, but it sounds pretty fucking cool.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, they've got, like you said, they got some really good bands playing every night, and it's just like a big open air bar slash festival. You just walk around and try lots of stuff. But you know, it is easy to spend a lot of money on booze there. I usually tell people, you know, A, pregame out in the parking lot, or B, you know, sneak some in. I've got a video on YouTube where I fill up a water bottle with gin, and I brought that into the Magic Kingdom, and I used to take those the little airline bottles of booze and put them in my socks, like, you know, and then walk in like that, because they don't pat you down.
No, they don't.
So anything yeah. you can put on your body, you can take in and bring those into the Magic Kingdom. I would bring in Malibu rum and then buy a Dole Whip, which is this kind of pineapple soft serve yes. type thing, and then put the I'd buy a Dole Whip float, actually, which has the pineapple juice in the bottom, and then dump in mm-hmm. two bottles of this.
I am trying that on my next trip because
so good.
Dole Whip is one of my favorite things on Earth. And I've heard people, they do that at Food and Wine, I heard. Like, yeah. last year they had the Dole Whip float with alcohol in it. And I'm like, oh, I've got to try that.
Yeah, they started doing that now. It's pretty funny because I would always say, why don't they sell this? Why don't they sell this? It's just common sense. And then, like a year ago, they started selling it, probably because people were losing money because people were bringing in their own booze and making it for themselves. So.
I am going to try that. Have you heard of a company called Orange Leaf? You know, the frozen yogurt type places.
Mm-hmm.
There's some here in Houston, and they carry actual Dole pineapple soft serve, and it tastes just like a Dole Whip. I walk in there, I'm like, can I just get a free sample? And it instantly takes me back to being at Magic Kingdom.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go in there one day, buy that, and then bring some little alcohol with me and sit outside and try that.
Yeah, definitely. I know a guy who actually ordered the mix from the company that makes it, and he has come up with a recipe for his soft serve ice cream maker where he actually uses booze in the recipe, and so it infuses into the Dole Whip, which is great. You know, he said the testing process for that was just absolutely, you know, such a hard time for him.
Oh, yeah. I can't even imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I feel sorry for that guy.
Drinking booze. Yeah.
My wife did that for me one year for a present. She bought me an ice cream maker and the actual mix from Dole, because you can order it.
Yeah, yeah. There's a place online, you get a big bag of it. And it tastes the same to me. I tried it, but I never could get the same texture down. But I think,
yeah, that's the thing.
Yeah, so.
At the park, where do I get Dole Whip? I don't know, because I know, Carrie, you told me to go get it at one point, but I don't remember where it was.
Well, now there's three places, so you can get it at in Magic Kingdom in Adventureland, kind of by the Tiki Room,
okay.
I guess.
Yes.
And then also at the Polynesian, you can get it at Captain Cook's, which they might be remodeling that area right now. I'm not sure, but they have a self-serve machine there that you can get it at. And then again at the Food and Wine Festival, there's a booth. I'm not sure which booth it is, but one of the booths sells it with the alcohol poured over it already.
Okay. And prepare to wait, because there's always a line for that, too.
Yeah. Really? Okay.
Yeah.
I'll have to try, because I'm going next weekend to Star Tours. So I'm hoping that we can jump over to Epcot and we're over to the Magic Kingdom and get something.
Yeah, I think Magic Kingdom's the most fun, you know, if you sneak in the airline bottles, because you can just kind of... You can just kind of get it and then chill out and just sit there and pee.
I want to report on that, JM. I want you to do that and bring a report back.
Okay. I have a mission now.
A drunken report from the bowels of Magic Kingdom.
Awesome.
So, not to leave Philip out here.
No, we're good.
How did you guys get together and decide, okay, we're going to do this, you know, documentary together on your book?
I had made a documentary in 2011. Didn't come out until about early 2013, but started making in 2011 about the Disney built town of Celebration, Florida. That's there, it pretty much inside the Walt Disney World.
I wanted to talk to you about that later, because I watched it, and it's just an amazing story.
Cool, yeah. I'm a big fan of that movie, obviously, because I made it. But when I was doing a lot of research on that film, I was turned on to Leonard's work, all the stuff he does through Bamboo Forest Publishing. And I kept going back to The Dark Side of Disney and reading it and just finding it super entertaining. And so I thought, hey, you know, when when my film came out, I was looking for, like, you know, different alternative avenues for promotion. And I thought, you know, that guy who wrote that book, he might like this. And so I sent him a copy of it, and he seemed to like it well enough. And then we started a conversation back and forth. And eventually I was like, you know what, I think we should I have this idea to adapt the Dark Side of Disney book into a documentary. And at first Leonard was a little hesitant, but I pitched it to him as sort of an evolution of the book. Like, half of the film could be an examination of the book as a series of sort of challenges. Look and see, can we actually, you know, achieve the things set out in the book? But then the other half of the film would be sort of an examination of these individuals who have been taking their Disney fandom to the next level. So that way the phrase Dark Side of Disney becomes this sort of, you know, double-edged idea where we examine the park stuff, and then we also get to meet these unique people.
Now, logistically, how are you guys going to be planning this out? Because I know Disney just doesn't allow anybody to come in and film.
Well, I actually was there a couple weeks ago, almost a month ago now, with went with my mom for the first time. I grew up going there all the time to Walt Disney World. I'm from Ohio originally, but this back in April, I was able to go back for the first time in almost a decade with my mom. And I walked in, you know, with a Canon 7D, DSLR, and a Zoom H4n audio recorder on top of it. And we filmed, you know, they don't care. They, especially with that kind of equipment, people observe it and see it and they think, oh, that's just some guy shooting some stuff. I walked around the park, all over the park, didn't sneak into the utilidors or anything, but filmed an interview with my mom by the castle, filmed the interview with my mom, like, near Tomorrowland, and filmed an interview with her on the Wedway People Mover, did all this stuff, and no one cared. No one mentioned anything. I think if you look at, you know, people bring up Escape from Tomorrow a lot
I wanted to talk to you guys about that.
Yeah, and that's a different, you know, totally different beast. Like, that's a narrative film where you have actors and you have to think about hitting your marks and remembering your lines and have to do reshoots and retakes and everything. The convenience we have with documentary filmmaking is that, you know, if something happens, we can move to another location and probably be fine with it.
It's definitely on the fly.
Yeah, it's definitely on the fly. There's no reason why it still shouldn't look good. And I think some of the stuff that we shot that day with my mom looks fantastic. We have an excerpt now on the Kickstarter page for the doc that I think is really powerful and really well done, and shows how we can achieve filming in the park pretty easily.
Now, yeah, you used a 7D. Like, if you walked in with, like, a C100 or something like that, people would be like, no, what are you doing? That looks too much like a film camera. But your normal, you know, DSLR, that's – people think you're a professional, number one, but I'm just taking photographs.
Yeah.
That's okay.
I mean, there's people do it all the time. There's a lot of, like, podcasts that, you know, the Mega 64 guys, if you're familiar with them at all.
Yeah.
They do, like, an annual, sometimes even more, like, episode where they just go to the Disney parks and record their podcast there. I know.
Oh, do they?
Yeah. Communicore Weekly, which is a little more Disney approved. They, you know, record stuff there all the time. And of course, that's audio. But even with recording video stuff, again, under the umbrella of, like, I'm just here with my family, like, filming my vacation. No one's going to say anything. And even if you had a C100, like, there, you could look at days, too, if you want to be crafty about it. There's, I believe, they used to, at least, and I think they still do, Disney used to promote these sort of, like, photo club days where, like, professional photographers come in, like, with tripods and all this stuff and are just, like, there to, like, snap pictures. Specifically, you know, think during, like, the garden festival, stuff like that. They would want people to come in and probably take photos of the flowers and things like that. So if you walked in with a high-end, you know, nice camera and were shooting some video of it, I don't think anyone would even say two things about it.
Are you using any stabilization equipment or anything?
Most part, I mean, we have a shoulder mount, of course, that we could easily use, some things like that. But then, of course, you enhance your conspicuous nature or inconspicuous.
a little bit
if you have a big shoulder mount on. So there's tricks, of course, that you can get around. You know, you can set up things where you're like resting on a bench or whatever, or just make sure you've, you know, not had too much coffee that day and your shakes are under control.
Right.
The other
get
benefit,
your steady handout.
Yeah, exactly. The benefit of also, you know, shooting documentary filmmaking is that, you know, you are shooting tons of footage. With a narrative film, you're looking for that specific take for that specific moment. With documentaries, you're a little more verite with it, and you're trying to just capture it as it happens. Of course, you want some stability with that, but the story really comes together in the editing room. So if we're just there all day, you know, I'm planning on going to two other guys, and they're going to have comparable cameras. So we're going to have, you know, we film for an 8-hour day. We're probably going to walk out of there with 5 or 6 hours of footage times three. Times 5 days, we're going to have a ton of footage that even if 75% of it is shaky handheld stuff that we have to throw away, that other 25% is going to be
talking about filming in Disney, and I think they're coming to get you right now.
I know, it sounds like they're coming to get you.
Yeah, I do. It's a really nice day here in New York, and I've got the window open, so that probably is. The Disney SWAT team is about to smash in through my windows. But I'm not that concerned with, like, you know, filming in the park. I think it's a fairly easy thing to do. And again, it, like I just said, it's probably going to be less than half of the film is actually filming in the park itself.
And it's interesting because you mentioned that kind of stuff. And I think Disney is very, like you talked about the podcasting people and everybody that comes in there and they film all the time. They're always filming things and they release it. As long as people know that it's, you know, a Disney copyrighted thing. They're usually pretty lax about it. And they don't care.
Yeah, the really interesting thing about Escape from Tomorrow right now is that that was all done without permits, and they are currently out on Netflix. They're out on Amazon. They have DVDs at the store you can buy.
I saw it at Target yesterday. I was like, wait a minute, it's in the store? I just thought it was digital.
And but, that's okay. Crazy. That's absolutely crazy because of the basically copyright infringement they're doing there. Again, the benefit of making a documentary is that we tend to fall under the umbrella of journalism, which allows us to get away with a lot more than you would in a narrative fictional story. So for as much of a problem as they had with that film, which was almost nothing as far as I can tell, I'm sure they had to have some sort of, you know, letter from legal at some point, but not that I've heard.
Right.
And obviously it hasn't, you know, impeded the process at all.
At the end of the day, your documentary and the other podcasters, you're still promoting Disney.
Yeah, I think that's the whole idea of, you know, there's no such thing as bad press. Like, you know, at the end of the day, Disney's going to see this, and it's not going to – there's no way that this film, the Dark Side of Disney documentary adaptation, there's no way that it's going to turn people away from going to Disney. People aren't going to look at it and be like, I'm not going to Disney. If anything, they're going to look at it and say, oh, I've never done Disney that way. And so, of course, if they get 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 more people to go to the park after seeing this documentary, that's the 10 people they didn't have going before.
Just like what Leonard said, people, they look at Disney as in this sort of like outside of a bubble, and they're like, oh, it's very family oriented, and it's, you know, I'm not going to have a good time there because I don't have kids or whatever, but you can have different experiences there.
Right. And one of the best things that I've said this before on other podcasts and whatnot, but one of the best things that Leonard said to me is when I initially interviewed him back in February, was like we were at the end of the conversation, and I said, you know, can you give me one final big tip, whatever it is? And I was expecting him to say, like, you know, eat some mushrooms and go on Spaceship Earth. It's
well, wait a minute, hey.
Right? But the tip that he came up with, he immediately didn't even have to think about it. He was like, the biggest thing I can say is that you need to respect everybody else that's there at the park. You know, some of these people have saved their whole lives in some cases. Some people have traveled from all over the world. And if you are like running around with, a megaphone screaming at people's faces, you're going to ruin their vacation. You're going to ruin their trip. So if the best thing you can do, the biggest tip I have for you is to respect the park and respect the people. And I definitely intend to do that. I'm not there to ruin anybody's good time.
Yeah, there's nothing ruins your day at Disney Park is running into some douchebags that are there just trying to cause problems.
Right.
And there are people like that out there.
Definitely, yeah. We're not there to disrupt anything. We're there just to sort of, you know, peek behind the curtain and look at it from a different perspective.
So let's talk about the Kickstarter. You guys are about halfway through your goal right now?
That's I think halfway is a good way is a gracious way to put it. we have about 9 days left, and we have about 13,000 more to raise. The thing that gets me excited about it is that you always, in almost every Kickstarter campaign, you see kind of a little big push there in the end. But we recently just broke 200 backers, which is awesome. Because like if I start to do these weird little math problems in my head, and I think, 200 people, if they all suddenly decided, hey, instead of the $5 or $10 I chipped in, I'm going to raise my, contribution to $100. And if all of those people raised it to 100, we would meet it immediately. Of course, that's not going to happen. Some people are, can't afford that, and that's completely understandable. But then, so the other math problem you can kind of do is, all right, well, we need to raise about 13,000. We have 204 backers. If we break it down, if each of those backers contributed something like $63 extra right now, then we would make it. So instead of everybody raising to $100 and evening the contribution, all they would have to do is kick in $63 and we would make it. And that's just based on right now. I think in the next week, we're going to see it come up to maybe hopefully another 100 backers. And so with each person that comes on board at this point, that point of entry for other backers to kind of ver that, step up level for other backers goes lower and lower. So worst comes to worst, like in the last minute, hopefully I could be like, guys, seriously, help me out.
Right.
and it may get to the point where it's only like $40 extra, and that's still a little bit of money. But, if you and I were going out to dinner and I conveniently forgot my wallet at home, you probably would help me out, maybe buy me a burger and a beer. That's $20 right there, especially in New York.
Well, the thing to remember is that, they're not just giving their money to you. They're getting stuff in return. You get a copy of the movie, you get a copy of the soundtrack, you get all this stuff. So it's not really a charity thing. Hopefully the prizes or whatever they call them are worth the money that people would spend on it.
Yeah, definitely. People are incentivized to many different levels to help out. $5 alone just gets you access to a digital version of the film when it's done. But as it goes up, you get some great things. You get, there are only a couple of people. I was surprised when I looked at it. 4 people have accepted the $250 reward. So if you pledge $250, you get like access to the movie once it's done. You get invited to a party here in New York that's going to be on my own rooftop. You get a soundtrack. You get a book signed by Leonard. You get special edition DVD or Blu-ray whenever that comes out. But then you also get, for $250, you get a handwritten thank you note from my own mother.
That's brilliant.
Along with a piece of Disney memorabilia from her own collection. So she's going to like handpick something, write a little letter, and then you get that with all the other rewards.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, very silly stuff. My mom, and that's one of the best things I think we have out there now to incentivize people, is I cut together a little clip from the film that's all about my mom talking about scattering my grandmother's ashes at the park. And I think it's a really good little excerpt that shows what we're going to try to achieve with that other half of the film. We're definitely going to be going in investigating the tips in the book, but looking at these obsessed fans like my mom, adds this kind of unique personal emotional level to the film. Because again, I think I know we're talking about the Kickstarter, but a lot of times the Kickstarter is the film too. But a lot of times, what we've been running into is people are like, "Well, I could go on YouTube and watch people goof off all the time, or I could I don't want to promote trespassing in the park," and it's not about that at all, because what we're trying to achieve is a documentary film. This is going to be a 90-minute documentary film that tells a story and is crafted like a professional film should be. It's not just going to be a 8-10-minute video of us running around jerking each other off.
So definitely, guys, if you want to help support, go to Kickstarter.com. You can either look for The Dark Side of Disney, a documentary film, or you can just look up Philip B. Swift. You can find them both that way.
Yeah, it's now, up there, and it's ready for your contributions.
I wanted to ask you, both of you guys, especially Leonard, when your book came out and, planning this documentary, what kind of negative feedback have you been getting from any, like, hardcore Disney files,
Oh boy. I mean, I've had people, you know, physically threaten me.
Really?
Oh yeah. People don't.
That's not the Disney way.
No, it's not. I've had Imagineers, say terrible things about me. No. I've had, one of the heads of D23, go on an active campaign to have me and my friends banned from the parks. So yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of backlash, and that's one of the reasons why I was hesitant to join up with Philip on this to begin with, because I'd gotten out of the whole backstage exploring and that kind of thing, mm-hmm. I guess about a year and a half ago, because I was turning into a legit publisher, and I was about to publish the autobiography of Rolly Crump, who was one of the Imagineers who worked with Walt. And, you know, I didn't think I should be bringing that kind of negative stuff onto him, I guess is the best way to put it.
Right.
Because like his son is an Imagineer and still works there. And so it would just reflect negatively on him if I was still, you know, out there doing these kind of things. So I stopped, but, you know, in the meantime, like a video I'd shot two weeks prior, it was kind of my big going away type of thing. I brought a big group of maybe about 30 people backstage at Epcot and pretended I was giving a tour and filmed the whole thing. And that went up on YouTube. And within 10 minutes, it had 600 views. And people were just freaking out. They were not thrilled at all. Just all this terrible stuff that people were calling me the Antichrist and, you know, saying someone should go to my house and hit me with a bat. And Jesus. Like, just, you know, it was, so that's the kind of thing that, you know, that's the kind of reaction that I've gotten. So I took that video down, but, you know, anytime the dark side of Disney kind of has a resurgence of popularity, yeah, I start getting negative remarks again. And surprisingly, this time when kind of the news broke on the documentary, we really didn't get a whole lot of negative publicity. I think the main thing that people were saying was, I don't want to donate to this Kickstarter because I'm basically funding someone's ban, like, you know, paying for someone to get banned from the parks. And I think Philip's done a good job kind of, you know, speaking to that and, you know, letting people know, like he just did, that this is a legit documentary and the point's not to get banned from the park or to be sensationalistic. He's actually making a real movie here. But yeah, I mean, there's, you know, pixie dusters, soccer moms, all these people who just think that Disney's, you know, 100% magical and nothing bad ever happens. And they get really mad when they find out otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And on the topic of banning too, like I think as a documentary filmmaker, I think that there's this like kind of mystery behind the banning, not only the fact that people do get banned, but also the process of it. And then the appeal process if you do get banned. And I think that if I go to Disney and I do something that gets me banned, first of all, today is Mother's Day, and so it's good to bring up that my mom, that would be the worst thing I could ever do to my mom is to get banned from Disney. She would be – I should probably disown me and be very upset. But if I did get banned, it wouldn't be the end of the road. It would be, people think it's this roadblock that comes up and nope, that's it. Movie's done. Get out of here. You know, you wasted all my time and effort, but it's not a roadblock at all. It's more of a fork in the road. And I think would help to enhance the dynamic quality of the film. I do not want to get banned. I'm not looking to get banned, but if it did happen, I would follow that road as far as it went and see what the process would be like.
So you're saying it'd be a great narrative point for the movie to turn.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, you get banned from Disney World. So then what's the appeal process like? Or what's even the banning process in general like? You know, I think Leonard knows about it, and I've learned a little bit from talking to some people that have been banned. But when you talk to 99% of the population, they have no idea that, A, you can get banned for life, mm-hmm. and, B, what that process is.
No, we're not recommending anybody go out there and do anything that will get you banned. But if you want to contact these guys and maybe you can be in the documentary.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to talk to, I don't want to drop any names or anything, but I've been trying to talk to some people about the process of what that's like. And we have at least one person lined up who's ready to tell us all about the process, probably in an anonymous factor in the film, mm-hmm. so that they can keep their identity secret. But it's just, I think it's really intriguing and interesting to see what the process is like, and definitely would be a compelling thing to watch in a documentary film.
Now, Leonard, while we you mentioned before, you have other books out on, you started your own publishing company. Let's talk about that, and let's talk about a little bit what other books you have. Definitely, I picked up the Rolly Crump book at D23 last year and actually got Rolly to actually autograph my copy.
Oh, nice.
Which is great.
Awesome. Yeah, that's great, because he, I don't know if you, how much you did there at D23, but there were several presentations with Imagineers, and one of them was mm-hmm. even called Working with Walt, to which Rolly was not invited. And
I did notice that, and I was very, I wondered why. Well, because I met them at the mice chat.
So that, Bruce? Yeah. That he, you know, he didn't leave the company. Well, that's not true. There were some people who kind of pushed him out of the company because they mm-hmm. were jerks. One of whom was Marty Sklar, who was the one who was hosting most of those panels.
Yeah.
And, you know, Rolly's a bit of a loose cannon. He'll pretty much say whatever he thinks, and maybe Marty didn't want him up on the panels for that reason. And then, like I said, D23, I'm not on their good list right now. They don't like me. But it was funny because, like you said, Rolly kind of went in through the back door and went to the Mice Chat booth instead, because mm-hmm. Mice Chat loves him, and went there and signed books and whatever. So that's really cool that you got one. You got him to sign it there. That's awesome.
I actually got a picture of him, but he wasn't looking at the same camera when picture was taken. So I'm looking at one camera, he's looking at a different camera. But at least I got a picture with him. He was a really nice guy, and his wife was real nice too.
Oh yeah, they're super cool, and you know I feel extremely lucky to be able to call them friends, and they're almost family at this point. They're just really sweet people.
That and the author of the book, I guess, he's also on Communicore Online.
Yeah,
podcast. Yeah,
yeah. Jeff Heimbuch. He does Communicore yep. Weekly, and he also writes for Mice Chat.
He was real nice to me too. I didn't realize who he was at first. I met so many Disney podcasters that weekend, and it was very under the radar type of thing, which was really cool.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's a kind of an interesting community of Disney fans, the podcasting group in general. And, you know, you've got mm-hmm. podcasts like yours, who are kind of, really into the idea of talking to someone like me and Jeff, his podcast does the same. Then you've got someone like Lou Mangiello, who's again, one of those kind of pixie dusters who thinks everything Disney does is awesome. And so it's interesting to see the fandom just, you know, through that microcosm.
Yeah, he's definitely become a celebrity in the Disney podcasting world. He's the one name everybody knows by now.
Yeah, that guy. I find his podcast to be very much like I found the travel guides that I was reading, which is, you know, very bland and very boring. So, I mean, you know, good guy, I'm sure, but I just don't want to listen to him.
I've met him a few times. Speaking of, so what Disney podcast do you recommend for people that want to be a little bit outside the box?
The one that I listen to on a regular basis is called it's WDW Kingdom Cast. So Walt Disney World Kingdom Cast. And they're a group of three guys who, you know, just curse constantly. They drink the whole time they're recording. They're a ton of fun. And so that's a good one. Walt Disney World Fanboys is good. And you've got Communicore Weekly, of course, that Jeff does, which is a very polished kind of podcast.
Yeah.
There's some other neat ones. Yeah. Well, you know, it takes all types. But, you know, the Season Pass podcast, I think, is interesting because they have some really good interviews with people who, you know, are big in the industry. They had a two-part interview with Tony Baxter that was just amazing.
Oh, interesting.
So, there's a lot of good ones out there. They come and go. You know, some people last 10 episodes and some people are on episode 300. So, but there's a lot of good stuff out there.
Now, go back to your publishing company. How did you decide, okay, so I've done this book now, and I want to release other books? And tell us about some of the other books that you guys have out.
Sure. Well, I wrote Dark Side Disney and self-published it because I tried to bring it to kind of mainstream big publishers, and they didn't want to have anything to do with it because they were scared of legal action from Disney.
So Birnbaum said no?
Yeah. A lot of these people just didn't even get back to me, and the ones that did were just like, yeah, we're not going to touch this with a 10-foot pole. So I, you know, I in my past life, I was a filmmaker, and I was a musician, and I'd self-released CDs, and I self-distributed my film before it got picked up by a real distributor. So, you know, I figured, hell, if I can do those things, I can publish a book myself, which I did. So I learned a lot about how to do that, and got a good team together. And Dark Side of Disney did really well. It's, you know, it was a bestseller. So after that, I decided to write a fiction book called Our Kingdom of Dust. And again, it's a Disney thing, kind of examining the crazy people who work there and live around there and who are obsessed with Disney. And so, again, I learned more doing that one, and then people start taking notice, I guess, of the quality of the products, of the books. So I got Ron Schneider on board for his autobiography, and Ron Schneider was the guy who kind of invented or played the character of Dreamfinder in Epcot.
Right.
And did some of the voice work for it, and turned out he has this, you know, lifelong career in theme park entertainment, and just a great show writer, great voice actor, had all these kind of wonderful stories about what it's like to work in that industry. So I published his book, and again, got Rolly Crump's book that Jeff helped him write, and that was a big deal. And we've got the other ones we've got out. We've got one called Hollow World by Nick Poberski, which is kind of like Die Hard in Disney World. And that's a lot of fun. And then I just published another book called Hapst and the Disney Saboteurs, which is another fiction book that takes place in Disney, kind of about this stoner guy who's an urban explorer who he films videos for YouTube of backstage stuff. And what he soon realizes, every time he films a backstage video, that ride ends up getting destroyed in some spectacular way. And so that gets pinned on him, and he has like 3 days to figure out who's really destroying these rides. So
it's very cool.
Yeah, it's fun. It's funny. So
I haven't talked to you, Leonard, since I got a copy of it from you, but I'm not done with it yet, but I really enjoy it. I think your description of it being like Fletch at Walt Disney World is pretty perfect.
Yeah. It's, you know, like anything I do, if people have read The Dark Side of Disney, they know it's got a lot of humor in it. You know, that's just kind of how I write, with a lot of wry sense of humor and a lot of curse words and that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Did you, I'm looking at your picture here on Skype, and did you ever get any flack for the actual cover of your book, The Dark Side of Disney?
Yeah, so that is, that's Draven Starr on the cover. And the time she did the cover, she wasn't in the porn industry, but she is back in the porn industry now. I've gotten, you know, people say that it's absolutely disgusting and they won't buy it because of the cover. And, you know, in my mind, that's great. You know, that cover, show, you know what you're getting into when you buy the book because of that cover. So anyone who is surprised by the material in the book after having seen the cover is a complete idiot. So, it definitely turns people off. But
it's mesmerizing, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, I think so too. that photo shoot was fun. So we had a good time.
So, Philip, let's talk about, you mentioned the documentary you did before called The Bubble, which is a documentary about Celebration Florida, which I've actually never been there, and I don't know why, but it's so close. It's right outside, you know, the bubble of Disney. Tell us, you know, how did you decide you were going to do a documentary on that city?
Well, let's see here. First, I grew up making narrative short films with my friends. It's just what we did, like, all the time growing up. From, like, 93 to 2005, we made probably over 100, like, you know, films. But when I moved to New York in 2006 to go to film school, finally to validate my, like, lifelong love of filmmaking, and when I got out of school, the first thing I realized is that I wasn't having as much fun making narrative films without my friends. And also it's insanely expensive to make narrative films, especially in New York. And so I transitioned into documentaries because it was more intriguing to me at that age and at that time. And it was also definitely much cheaper. You could start making a film on a topic that you were interested in, and you would create this story in the editing room, which is something I said before. And that's something that I became more and more, I think as a more and more of a professional filmmaker, it was really the editing process that I enjoyed the most. I
agree on that one.
Yeah,
I love editing.
Like, I love to shoot and I love to interview people and I love to, you know, do everything else, but it's just the editing that I love the most. And so I think it's why documentary became this sort of format that I preferred. The one thing I don't like to do, honestly, is I'm not a big fan of the writing process, because my mind tends to like race ahead of the ideas I'm trying to put on the page.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with documentary, you can go and talk to someone for an hour or 2 hours and then come back and edit it and create a new conversation and find what you were trying to do in the editing room. So anyways, in 2008, made a short documentary that was released in 2010, actually started in 2008, came out in 2010, that was all about growing up in Ohio, making movies with my friends. And sadly, one of my best friends passed away in 2004 from leukemia. And it was actually just recently the 10th anniversary of his death. But I went back to make a film about this. We had made this in my senior year of high school in 1998. My friends, like a small group of friends and I, made an hour-long movie that's super silly called Dear Mothman. It's this fairly – we thought it was a fairly serious take on the John Keel book, The Mothman Prophecies, which was later made into a Hollywood movie starring Richard Gere. It's this goofy little weird movie that, like, as high school seniors, we were really proud we were able to make this hour long film. But then when I went back in 2008 to interview everybody about the movie, that was my intention for the documentary initially, was to make this short documentary looking at the 10th anniversary of this silly film. But the thing that kept coming up was that my best friend, one of our friends, of course, had passed away. And so I made this what I think is a really great short film that is about a group of friends, like, goofing off, having fun, making these movies, but then realizing the importance of these, you know, goofy movies when one of our friends isn't here anymore. And so then that, like, fully, like, sealed the fact that I wanted to, you know, get into documentaries full on. I had a little bit of success with that film. I got a little bit of recognition. And then in 2011, a year after I was done with that one, I was starting to think about what the next film was going to be, and I wanted to step up to a feature-length format. And I teach filmmaking here in high schools in New York through the Tribeca Film Institute and a group called Young Audiences. But and because of that, I'm lucky to have the, you know, high school, like, academic calendar, so I get to enjoy the spring breaks and summer breaks and all that stuff again. And so in 2011, my wife said to me, she said, what are we going to do for spring break? You know, she had time off and I had time off. And I kept thinking about Celebration, Florida, because the previous fall there had been the murder in the town. A man was at the time it was reported that he was just bludgeoned with an axe, and it came out much later that he was actually strangled with shoelaces and then bludgeoned with an axe. And then it was odd because after that initial story came out about the murder, this big thing came out about how there was this swingers scene. And somebody had even been quoted in a British newspaper as, I never met so many swingers until I moved to Celebration, Florida. and I immediately, like, when I started reading these stories, the tagline actually came to me very early on, the whole idea of, like, murder, sex, Disney. This town has it all. And so my wife and I went down April of 2011, and I was able, because of my education background, I was able to get interviews with the high school principal in Celebration and the drama teacher, and then they, you know, connected me to some other people. And before I knew it, like, we spent spring break there, and I came home with 6 or 7 interviews that I was able to cut into a little bit of a proof of concept, you know, 10-minute thing, and then we did a Kickstarter then to raise some money for that. And that worked out pretty well. So then I was able to go back in November of 2011 for about 10 days, with my friend who's a professional cinematographer. And, it was interesting to see the shift. Like, before the Kickstarter, I was reaching out to a lot of people saying, I'd love to talk to you about the town, love to talk to you about this. But when we did the Kickstarter, it was out there in the world that we were going to make this movie. So I started having all these people come to me and say, like, oh, I've got stories that will keep you up for days. And stuff like that. And oddly enough, when we actually did talk to people, they were very tame stories. But so in the end, I was really happy to create this film because I was expecting to go in and it being this crazy, you know, insane town where everyone was I pictured like a John Carpenter movie or something where everyone was just running around screaming and having sex and shooting everybody or something or strangling them with shoelaces. But at the end of the day, it's just a basic normal town. It just happened to have been founded and built by Disney. If you talk about murder or sex, I mean, I live in New York, that we see that every second here in the city, so it's not that unique. And so I was really proud at the end of the day to make a film that I think is the bubble is very objective in its point of view. Like there's no narration from me. There's no, besides the obvious editing of the film, my voice is pretty much left out of the film. And I just let the people of the town tell the story of this town from their point of view. And so that's why it's interesting in the film. There's a great, one of my favorite segments is about the swingers. And it's this really just simple 3-minute like edited piece where everyone, it's going back and forth between like 12 different people or something and all of their different perceptions of what the swinger scene is in the town. And at the end of the day, the segment actually has nothing to do with swingers. It's more about like the rumor mill that is created in a small town like that. Because no one has, everybody has their own different opinion. You know, one person says it's oh, you're definitely swingers. Every Thursday night, swingers night. And the next person will be like, no, there's no swingers. It's a bunch of like golfers who call themselves swingers, and they thought it was funny. To one person being like, oh no, yeah, definitely, I was there. I saw a blow up doll. You know, it was crazy. So
yeah. And it wasn't a Mickey Mouse blow up.
It was not a Mickey Mouse blow up doll. But yeah, so then we wrapped that film up. I was able to do the editing in summer of 2012, and a friend of mine actually works at Pixar, so we were able to do sort of a pre-launch screening at Pixar in September of 2012, and then we hit the switch on it in the beginning of 2013, and it's out there now for the world to consume.
So where can people get view a copy of it?
The easiest way to get to it is through the website. That's thebubbledocumentary.com. It's available on Amazon for VOD and DVD. And it's fun to watch now that the film's out there. It was fun to initially see the sort of, like Leonard was talking about, that backlash that comes out from people. Of course, you know, you make a movie about a town. There are people that live there and are invested in the community. And I don't want to do anything to... same thing with, you know, going to the Disney parks and screwing around. I don't want to mess up anybody's lives. So people see the tagline "Murder, Sex, Disney," and especially the people that live in Celebration. And I was getting a lot of immediately, the biggest spike we saw on the website was from this private message board that only the people of Celebration have access to. And what it basically was, people were like, how dare you, like, you know, scar the good name of our town. You know, we are good people, blah, blah, blah. And I was very, you know, cordial to these people, very level-headed, and I would respond to every complaint. I would say, I'm sorry you feel that way. Here's a free copy of the film you can watch online. Let me know what you think about it. And, you know, 9 out of 10 times, people came back and were like, oh, yeah, okay, cool. This is actually, you did a great job. Like, you know, the tagline may be a little sensationalistic, but the film is not. There's those Disney police again.
They're coming to get you.
Right. The tagline might be sensationalistic, but the film is definitely not. And so then it was nice to see actual, like, people from the town, you know, see it as a company.
Now, what kind of equipment do you use?
This is a weird side note, but really quick. In 2006, there was a Danish-produced documentary about the town just called Celebration. And that is a weird movie. That is, it's hard to find. A guy interviewed in the bubble gave me a copy of it. It is a weird, weird movie because they focus on this one woman who calls herself the alchemist of Celebration. And she's just like a woman that makes makes lotions and stuff and sells them like on Etsy probably. Right. But it has this really weird thing in it where they'll be interviewing a family in their house. And they do this sort of like 360, like, you know, full, like, the camera pans around in this 360 way, but it feels, and it shows like the whole house and the family, but it feels really weird. And it's because, like, it's actually a series of, like, you know, stills stitched together that they're digitally, like, creating this panorama of. And it, uh-huh. And it just feels weird when you watch it, and the music's very weird, and the interviews are very strange, and It's a very bizarre film, and so seeing a film like that made me realize that's probably what the celebration residents were probably afraid of.
Your film has definitely caused me to want to actually visit next time I'm down in Florida, because I always heard about it, but I never actually stopped and just checked it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting little town there. The author Naomi Klein, who wrote a book called No Logo, has a little bit about Celebration in it, and she talks about how it's interesting because it feels like this not necessarily a town, but like a museum of what towns used to be. Mm-hmm. Specifically to the point where there's like a Starbucks in the town and stuff like that.
But, oh, is there?
Yeah, but in 96...
Well, where isn't there a Starbucks?
Right. In 96, when she, I think, wrote the part in the book about it, there was no sort of like logos anywhere. There were no like, you know, corporate branding anywhere, even though it was this Disney town. Mm-hmm. They had there was like a water tower when you drove into town that said Disney's Town of Celebration, but even that they like took the Disney name off of eventually within the first year of the town being there. And so it does feel like this weird living museum. And there's a segment in the bubble where the residents talk about how, you know, people come up to them every day and are like, oh my god, are you like a robot, are you a animatronic robot? But it's just a normal town that has an elementary school and a high school. It has even there's a university there. There's four different kinds of churches you can go to. There's everything you could ever want in this weird little 8,000 person town. Everything except for gas and groceries.
Right. I thought that was weird in the movie.
Well, they actually just built that way when I was there in April in Orlando with my mom. We drove through again just to check it out, and they did actually just build a new like grocery store. So. They got that. Okay. Now all they need is gas.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it reminds me of, you know, what Walt Disney was trying to do with his ideas for, like, the Main Street USA, and then, like, what eventually, you know, his original ideas for, like, Epcot Center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what some people will say, that this is the Disney Corporation sort of wanted to revisit that idea of the experimental prototype community of tomorrow when they were going to build this town. And then what the board of directors or whoever, what they decided to do instead was to build a town that was more like the town that Walt Disney grew up in, rather than create this, you know, mm-hmm. progress city. Because there are some cool innovations in the town, even like all of the power and telecommunication lines are underground. So even when there's like hurricane weather, like blowing through Florida, Celebration, to further enhance like the bubble metaphor, they have never had like a power outage or like a telecommunications outage in, you know, almost 20 years of the town. Jeez. Being around. Yeah, which is insane. Like whenever there is like power outages in the area, they'll open up the, you know, the school and the church and like things like that for people
right.
to come and like, you know, hide out in, because they still have power, they still have communication.
So let's get into the topic. Well, one of all of our favorite topics. Let's talk about Disney and mm-hmm. some tips and tricks and things like that. You mentioned that you were just there in April. Did you get a chance to do the new Magic Band Plus and all that stuff?
I did. It gets a lot of negative press, and like I said, I don't know what the transition was like to it, and they were still going through the early transition. And people are I've seen a lot of people being like, oh my god, now Disney's going to track you wherever you go. But the thing that I noticed...
A little bit, maybe, but
right.
That's okay.
So my mom is an annual pass holder, and she, of course, had the whole Magic Band and everything. But then what she did is she bought me a ticket on her, as a guest of her annual pass. So they just gave me one of the old classic RFID cards. I didn't have a band, mm-hmm. set of cards like everybody else. And it worked the same way as the Magic Band. So when we did our Fast Pass stuff, I just walked up to the thing and held my card in front of it, and we were good to go. In general, I had no problem with it. I'm not like a super crazy like Disney enthusiast. My mom is, and she had a lot to say about the fact that like you could only do three fast passes. You could only sign up for three fast passes, and then that was it. Which though recently, I think in the last week,
yeah, they're changing that.
They changed it, which is great. Maybe they heard my mom through her like secret hidden microphone in the Magic Band, but tracking her. So I was impressed with it in general. The thing I hadn't, the thing I'd forgotten about that I wasn't aware of when I was a child and wasn't trying to like shoot an interview with someone is how goddamn noisy that park is. That there's like four kinds of music like assaulting you from four different like angles constantly, and of course there's like the crowds and the families and everything. And I was amazed, you know, how noisy it was. But one big tip that my mom, being this like veteran, you know, Disney park goer, that we had, we only went to the Magic Kingdom, but, she did the classic trick of, we drove in cause she had a rental car and we would go to the Contemporary and she would just, they would like, what are you here for? And she would say, right. Oh, we're here to meet a friend for breakfast or whatever, park at the Contemporary. And then you're like a 5-minute walk to the Magic Kingdom. You don't have to worry about any of the big, crowds or hustle and bustle.
Or just jump, you know, jump on the monorail there.
Yeah, exactly. Which we did because I missed going on the monorail. It was nice to get there again. But I'm sure the Leonard's got a whole hat full of tricks.
Oh yeah, well, I mean the book's got a ton of them in it, and I keep the book updated. I think I last updated it maybe 2 months ago. So I try to keep it, you know, up to date as much as possible. But surprisingly, a lot of the stuff that's in the book is still valid, even though the book came out in 2011. Like the free parking trick, like Philip was just saying, that you can still do that. So, yeah.
Leonard, what is it? This is, I'm going to take over as a host for a second, I guess. What's your opinion on the Magic Band stuff and the whole FastPass Plus? Because like I actually participating in it, I was fine with it. It seemed fine, but I could understand if people had some negative things about it.
I mean, I wasn't a fan of FastPass to begin with. I think everyone's kind of forgotten that, you know, there was a time when there was no FastPass and when you know, you waited in line for a ride if you wanted to go on it, and it was fine. Everyone was fine with that. I was fine. I don't ever remember like being mad that I was waiting in the line because since there was no FastPass and there was no, you know, standby line, if you didn't, the lines were shorter. That's all there was to it. They moved a lot faster because you didn't have all these people with FastPasses coming in and jumping to the front of the line. So, I never had a problem with it. The other thing is now with the My Magic Band, the FastPass Plus, they're putting FastPasses on rides that absolutely do not need a FastPass. In fact, they were designed they call them people eaters, to move a large number of people in a very short amount of time, something like Spaceship Earth, for example. And now Spaceship Earth has FastPass. I can't remember the last time I waited in line for Spaceship Earth. Pirates of the Caribbean, the same way. You know, I think the longest I've ever waited in line for that was maybe 15 minutes.
Yeah, that's the longest I've ever waited.
Yeah, it does create this sort of stigma, because then, like I said, when I was there with my mom, we just fast-passed the mountains, basically. Space Mountain, Splash Mountain, Big Thunder Mountain, and we were like, had them all knocked out by noon. And then we went over to get on Pirates, and there was like it was literally like a 25-minute wait or something, and my mom immediately was like, nope. Don't want to do it. I was like, why? What's the problem? We'll just get in line. It's like it's one of the cooler like lines to wait in, like temperature wise. But I agree, because it does create this sort of like almost like classist thing. Because I did feel weird like just cutting through the line and watching all of these other people that were like waiting in line.
And people get mad when you, what are you doing? Hey, what are you doing? Yeah. Well, I have this fast pass. Mm-hmm. You could have got the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. People get pissed off. And, you know, as far back as I'd say two years ago, when I first heard about the Magic Band thing, I immediately started raising security concerns about it because it's all RFID technology, and ended up actually talking to one of the developers who was working for the company that was making them, and got him to kind of pass on all these questions and concerns to the team that was working on them. And they actually did get back to me with answers for a lot of the questions I had, and the ones that they didn't get back to me on, they just never got back to me on. So you know, for example, when they first rolled the Magic Bands out, the whole thing was you could just hold your band up to any place when you bought food or drink or souvenirs or anything and pay through the band, because your credit card was linked to this Magic Band. And soon enough, after I sent the stuff off, they were like, oh, okay, well, now you're going to have to enter a PIN in there, and you're not just...
Yeah, because that's scary, because what if you're just walking by someplace, and it picks up your band, and it starts charging you for something?
Well, even more than that, it was that someone could walk up to you, and this is what I found, is that they have RFID cloners, where if someone gets close enough to you... You can read all the information on your band and then clone it to another band. And so without a PIN, they would be able to charge, you know, whatever they wanted until until that was found out. And same thing with the room key. Your room key's on there. And so this is one of the things they didn't get back to you about. So if someone's kind of waiting around a corner in your hotel, they see you come out of your room, they walk past you, read your thing, they know which room you're staying in now. They can get right into your room and steal all your stuff.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, that sort of thing was interesting. They did come back to me. So there's actually two RFID chips in those bands. There's a passive one, and that's the one that's used for your room key and for charging and all that. And then there's an active one. So there's actually a battery in there and that one broadcasts information. And what they're using that for going forward is for like characters and things on rides where it'll send your name to this character or to this ride. So when you're riding by it or when you see a character, they'll say, hey, Leonard, how are you? Mickey Mouse will say, hey, Leonard, and I'll be like,
it's
hey,
like
Mickey.
Do you ever been on the E.T. ride
over
Universal?
Yeah, I was going to say that's exactly what, because I loved it because you would like do it at the beginning and you give your name and then at the end it'd be like, oh, hello, Philip, Carrie, Leonard.
Exactly. So they came back to me and said that they were actually also using that active transmitter to basically track your location in the park, which they are doing, but for the they view it as a security feature also, because if they see two duplicate RFID transmitters, they'll know that one of them is a clone and they'll shut them both down for security reasons.
And I'm sure they can use it as well now for like measuring line weight too, because before, you know, every once in a while they give you a card when you walk into, hey, when you get to the inn, give us this card and we can, you know, that's how they time how long the wait is.
Yep, exactly.
Actually, they gave me a card and I had a magic band on when I went on Space Mountain.
They're still perfecting technology, but you know, they can tell. So, you know, you go on this ride and then immediately after you go buy a popsicle somewhere, you know, a Mickey Fudge Bar. Well, maybe now we need to move that Mickey Fudge Bar stand a little bit closer to the ride exit. Or you know, everyone who gets off Mission Space doesn't eat for the next 12 hours. You know, okay, well, maybe we need to shut down Mission Space, you know, or something. So they can use this to for a lot of different metrics and to make more money. And regardless of what they're telling anyone about how it's, you know, enhancing your experience and all that, that's a bunch of crap. They're doing it so they can make more money.
Oh, yeah.
That's the bottom line.
Exactly. I mean, it's for them to get better information without having to, you know, interview everybody that walks in the damn park.
Yep.
There's also something to be said, to go back to just this one second I was thinking about with the whole waiting in lines like mentality. There's got to be something on like the psychological level that I remember as a child, like, okay, it's annoying I have to wait in line for an hour to get on Splash Mountain, but when I finally got to go on the ride, it was like such a big thing. If everybody's fast passing and you just cut right to the front of the line, it diminishes the experience, I think. You know what I mean? And then that could just be like the old man in me being like, kids today, they got it to eat.
It's definitely along the lines of, you know, I guess Disney World is different now with, you know, when it regards to people that are handicapped and need special. Now, I guess I haven't seen this myself, but they give you a special card. It's sort of like a fast pass, so you still have to wait, but you just don't jump right in every single line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
is
exactly
that correct?
They give you a time when you can return. So I
sort of like that better, because I know Disneyland is not like that yet. They haven't done anything different there.
No, Disneyland, you just go into the Fast Pass line. Yeah.
Yeah, you just walk straight up to every ride that you want, basically.
Yep, that's true. And, you know, there's also a big thing in the book that I describe, kind of the back entrances to all these rides. And even without that card, if you're in a wheelchair, you can get to the front of the line by going through these back wheelchair entrances. Just because a lot of these rides were built pre-ADA, and so wheelchairs can't actually physically fit through some of these lines, so they have an alternate entrance. So, yeah, I mean, if you're in a wheelchair, a lot of times you can get to the front of the line, and that's just the way it is. They're slowly refurbishing a lot of the queues to be wider, and to just because there's so many people on scooters these days going to the park, so they're slowly refurbishing the queues to be handicapped.
Don't get me started on that one.
Oh, yeah, man, such a pain in the ass. Between the scooters and the strollers, it's like, geez.
Scooters, strollers, and people that wear socks and sandals at the park. What the hell? And when I was there a couple years ago, I haven't been in about 3 years to Disney World, But there was, like, I guess, you know, a lot of Europeans are there, and they all wear sandals all day, just, you know, the little flip-flop sandals. I'm like, I'm wearing, like, great, you know, really padded shoes, and my feet hurt. How the hell are they getting around all day?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Question for the ages. So what other tips and tricks do you guys have for, like, a non-Disney fan?
For enjoying their trip, you mean?
Yes, sir.
Drink a lot.
I think one of the biggest things you can do if you've never been to the park or something before is to, and it's sad to say, but it is sort of like lower your expectations. Like, you have to be prepared to enjoy some boring things if you've never been there before. Like, I love going as somebody who's been going my whole life. I love going to the Hall of Presidents. You know, I love seeing those robots do their things. I love to get on the Carousel of Progress and see, like, the history of it. Like, I really, like, enjoy that, like, this is something that was made, like, you know, so long ago, and it was like the first like idea of like an animatronic entertainment. So I appreciate it from that aspect. And then if I want a thrill, I can go get on Space Mountain and stuff like that.
I think one of my biggest tips is you're not going to be able to see everything, so don't try. Don't get frustrated that you haven't been on every single ride in one day.
Mm-hmm.
People tend to do that. They're like, oh, well, I'm going to have to do this and this and this, and they get very Nazi about it, about their schedule, you know?
Yeah, my mom was one of those worst, you know, people ever for that. She was so crazy about, like, you know, okay, I'm going to hold your hand, and we're going to run, and we're going to get on this ride, and then we're going to go see this parade, but if we leave, like, 5 minutes before the parade's over, then we can, like, sneak over here because there's no line, and we would, like, hustle, like, through that park every day, and she still does that. I was impressed by walking with her around there just last month, how much she still just hustles to get through that park and, like, see everything in one day. And it's just, like, the way that she enjoys it, I guess.
I think that having a Magic Pass actually helps you quite a bit, or annual pass holder. I know that not everybody can have that, but from the experience that I've had so far, it's so much more convenient because we can actually explore the park on our own basis rather than have to try to cram everything in.
Yeah, exactly. As a local, you could just go to, you know, a park for 2 hours and then leave and be perfectly happy.
Yeah.
We're going to start going at night.
Yeah.
I thought it was cool with how you have the app on your phone, and then you could just be like, okay, I'm going to fast pass. You could be, you know, out at dinner somewhere a mile away from the park, but have it already planned out that you're going to go get on Splash Mountain in 2 hours.
That's actually how we planned out my wife's birthday. We walked around Disney with one of our friends of the show, a design geek and his wife. We walked around the park. They showed us their ins and outs because they're annual pass holders as well. And they went their own way, and we had our reservations at 7:30 at Tony's and ended up going to we were going to leave and go to Epcot so we could watch the fireworks a little bit differently, but we got stuck.
So you went to Tony's, right?
Yes.
Did you have to have the spaghetti? Did you do the scene from the movie?
No, but I actually watched the movie inside the waiting area. So,
of course.
Yeah. But it's very interesting. I'm pretty much a noob when it comes to Disney, so I haven't read your book yet, and I'm sorry, but I think I'm going to have to now.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fun book to read, I think. And you'll definitely find some tips and tricks in there that you're definitely not going to see anywhere else.
So on the topic of food, let's go back to that. What is your guys' favorite? What is your favorite places to eat at any of the parks or even outside the parks?
There's a few that I always do. Obviously, World Showcase is great because you can just go around and get, you know, food from each country and a little snack here, a little snack there. That's always a lot of fun. But I'm trying to think some of the places I go. It's the sci-fi one in MGM. I know a lot of people really.
I know you're old school when you said MGM.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. I don't.
Yeah, I still call
it Hollywood Studios now. Yeah, I
it's hard to say that.
But people crap on that a lot. But I really enjoy it there.
I do too. I spent a lot of time growing there as a kid. My grandmother lived in Fort Lauderdale, and every summer I would go. I've probably been like at least 30 times in my life. And I always loved the sci-fi dining. I loved it.
Yeah. I think it's a great atmosphere, and it's a lot of fun. And the food's good to me, I like it anyway.
Good-ish for a theme park.
Yeah. Now, my favorite food thing that I tell people that they got to do is in the Magic Kingdom at Pecos Bill's. It's a counter service place, and it's nothing special except for they have a toppings bar. And
I've heard of this.
This big bar where you can load up on all these different toppings. They have sautéed mushrooms, sautéed onions, hot from the grill right in back there. They have shredded cheese. They have like nacho cheese, squirt cheese, salsa, all this stuff. So when I was in college and would go there and had no money, I would just kind of load up on the toppings bar, and that was it. Like I would just just eat from the toppings bar and not even buy anything. Now what I do is I order the fries, order fries there at Pecos Bill's, and I ask for the fries come in a cup, so I'll ask for a plate, and I'll dump them on the plate, go over the toppings bar, and just load up on with these fries, and it's a huge full meal for the price of an order of fries, which is pretty cheap. And so now those are actually known as Kinsey fries. So I'll get pictures. People will send me pictures of their Kinsey fries and or post them on Twitter and tag me. And it's always pretty funny. So, yeah.
So about 5 or 6 years, my favorite place is Ohana.
Oh, yeah.
About 5 or 6 years ago, I took my nieces there for their very first trip. And one was like 15, one was 9. So the youngest one, who is now 15, I asked her, what do you remember the most about the trip? And it always comes back to Ohana.
Yeah, that's good.
I was like, where do you want to go for your birthday? I want to go to Ohana. I'm like, well, yeah, so do I, but
and the
let's start driving now.
I mean, that the Polynesian Hotel is just a beautiful place. And you know, they're refurbishing it now, and they're going to put a Trader Sam's in there, which is cool. But Ohana and the Tambu Lounge right next to it. That's a great place to get a drink while you're waiting to get seated in Ohana.
Yeah, I had a good experience. My mom and I the day that we just went, like I said, the one day to Magic Kingdom. But we actually, even though we went to a Contemporary and parked and said we were meeting a friend for breakfast, we actually did have the breakfast buffet there. And while it's a little bit pricey, it's a really good breakfast buffet. Then we took a break in the middle of the afternoon and hopped on the monorail over to the Polynesian and went to the restaurant there for lunch. And I was impressed by how thought it was really good. And then I was walking by the bar to go to the bathroom, and I saw like a classic like Disney scene, which was this woman full bridal gown, like probably getting married that day there at the wedding pavilion. But she was sitting there by herself at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, just like drinking like a stiff drink. and I thought that was pretty awesome.
It's great.
Well, and so what is your favorite, Philip?
It's been a while. Since I like those two play, I had a great time. We had breakfast and lunch there, and both of those were really good. I was impressed with just walking around looking at the park. They had the new Fantasyland stuff, which I wasn't 100% happy with a lot of it. And
I haven't seen any of that yet, actually.
Yeah, and the new Snow White minecart ride, whatever, wasn't open yet. But we did walk into the Gaston's pub, and they had, instead of like the turkey legs that are all over, they had their equivalent of that at the pub, and it was like a giant like pork loin. Which I've heard is fantastic. I think on the Communicore Weekly, like Heimbuck and Taylor were talking about that.
I got to say, I'm not a fan of the turkey leg.
Yeah, I'm not a fan. It freaks me out.
It's weird. Yeah.
I think in general, that kind of stuff, like I'm not a big fan of it being like a hot Florida day. And then you see like some dude jamming like salty popcorn in his mouth. I'm like, what is wrong with you? What's your problem? And then
I love Disney popcorn. There's something about it.
There's something about the salt that they use. Definitely. Maybe at night where you're watching fireworks or something, that's cool. But in the middle of the day,
not in the middle of the day.
But this pork loin that they have is supposedly really good, and it's not that expensive because it's this giant thing you get. And but I can't think of any, like, I know growing up we would go, my mom always, like, there was one year where she went like all out and like got that whole thing where everything's taken care of. It's just like all in the card and you can eat wherever. And we ate at, I can't think of the name of it. Maybe obviously Leonard would probably know that it's like a really fancy restaurant in the Grand Floridian Hotel. And it's like two people's names.
Victoria and Albert's.
Yeah, we ate there for, it was like, I think it may have been like Thanksgiving or something. Yeah, and it was, I remember, I was probably only like 12 at the time, and I was
super expensive.
Super impressed. Yeah, I mean, my mom was, she was just like a single mom who was a nurse. And then it was my mom, my grandmother, and I went, and I was just like, you know, I don't know. I was too young to probably appreciate it, but I was blown away by how good it was. But
I spent my honeymoon at Disney World, and we did that. We had the Disney dining whatever plan,
mm-hmm.
and we definitely tried some places that we would normally never go to. Some of them good, some of them not so good.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's if you get it for free, it's definitely worth it.
Yeah.
The one restaurant that I ate out last time that I truly loved was Cat Cora. Restaurant on the boardwalk.
That's funny. My wife and my mom went there because I was still teaching, and they actually happened to meet up in Florida like a couple days before I could get down there, and they went to that restaurant, and they loved it.
I heard it's closing down, though.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that. Yeah,
they're changing it into something else, yeah.
Yeah, That's the problem. Stop liking stuff, and then it won't go away, just like TV shows.
Yeah.
Oh. Speaking of all the cancellations this week, I'm not going to go there.
Yeah.
It's community.
That's a bummer.
Every year there's some heartbreak. And you know what? I'm happy that Dan Harmon got to come back, and I think that last episode they did was actually really good for a last episode. So.
Oh yeah, it was definitely closure in the G.I. Joe episode they did this year.
Yeah,
simply brilliant.
Definitely.
I'm actually wearing my community my property of the Human Beings Athletic Department right now.
Nice.
Got to wear in support, sort of RIP.
Mm, yeah, definitely.
Great show.
So thank you guys for coming on the show. I don't want to keep you guys too long, but as we wrap up here, let's remind everybody where they can get a hold of all the projects your guys are working on separately and together.
Leonard, you want to go first?
Yeah, I'll start. So my publishing company is Bamboo Forest Publishing, and you can go to bambooforestpublishing.com. And see what I'm up to. Also, darksideofdisney.com. I post there occasionally. And all my books are on Amazon, iTunes, Barnes & Noble, pretty much anywhere you can buy a book, you'll find me. And so now Philip can go.
Tuesday, May 20th is the absolute last day to contribute to the Kickstarter for the Dark Side of Disney documentary adaptation. I talked a little bit. To get there, go to kickstarter.com, look for Dark Side of Disney. I talked a little bit about the math that drives me crazy, but just a couple other numbers that freak me out is that the video, the pitch video that's on the site that for the campaign, it has had 26,000 views since it's been up. It's only been like, 20 days that it's been up, 22 days. So if everybody that watched that video threw in a dollar, we would be there. We would be there. Half the people threw in a dollar, we would make our
goal.
The other thing is the campaign has been shared almost 1,000 times on Facebook, just on Facebook, let alone like Twitter and everything else. So again, 1,000 shares. If each of those people gave, you know, $2, that would help out a lot. If each of those people gave like $10, we would be there. We would be so close. It is definitely stressing me out. I don't sleep anymore, but I think in 9 days, on May 20th, when it's all said and done, I think we're going to be there.
Sleep is overrated.
Yeah. We've got some good things lined up this upcoming week, to promote the film and try to get it out there. So keep your eyes open, internet, and, take a look at it.
So thank you guys. Let's give everybody, I guess, a rundown on us real quick. First of all, a couple of sponsors that we need to thank. We are one of the sponsors of Comic Palooza, which will be here in Houston, Texas, May 23rd through 26th. Some huge guest announcements still to be made that I can't speak about quite yet, but we're going to have four of the Doctor Who doctors are going to be there.
What?
Yes. Five agents from S.H.I.E.L.D. We actually will have Coulson himself. We're going to have Clark Gregg there.
Oh.
Wow.
Yeah, we have a lot of great guests coming this year.
Which four doctors are you guys keeping? I'm sorry to interrupt your plug.
No, not a secret. Paul McGann is going to be there.
What?
Let's
Alien
see.
3? I love Paul McGann and Alien 3. So good.
Right? Let's see. You're going to make me pull up my list now.
Yeah.
I'm actually the social media coordinator for Comic Palooza, so it's a sort of, I should know, right?
Probably, but that's okay.
Right.
That's why we have the internet.
We're going to actually have one Disney guest. We're going to have Jim Cummings there, the voice of Winnie the Pooh, Tigger, Darkwing Duck.
Nice.
So let's
Sylvester McCoy, Colin
Peter Davison,
Colin Baker.
Wow.
Yeah, that's awesome.
John Barrowman will be there as well.
Really?
Paul McGann, Colin Baker, Sylvester McCoy. Then we're going to have Clark Gregg, Elizabeth Henstridge, Brett Dalton, Ming-Na Wen, and August J. Richards.
Mm,
Deathstroke himself, or yeah. Deathlock, I'm sorry. J. August Richards. My wife is correcting me. Billy D. Williams, Cary Elwes.
Billy D. Williams there. You got, I would lead with Billy D.
I know, right? But yeah, don't mention Billy D. Williams in leading again. You saw his Dancing with the Stars performance.
Well, yeah, and his absence from episode 7. What's up with that?
Oh yeah, that's true. Because originally, one of the reasons this is a weird story. One of the reasons why we originally had Peter Mayhew. He's been like almost every year. He had to cancel because we put out that he was filming something. What else is Peter Mayhew going to be filming but right. Star Wars? So we were one of the reasons why it was sort of leaked out that Chewbacca himself, Peter Mayhew, was going to be in the new Star Wars movie. They weren't too happy with that either.
Cool.
But yeah, I mean, a lot of great guests. So if you guys are wanting to go, go to comicpalooza.com/register, put in the code MetalGeek when you're checking out, and you're going to save up to $5 off your pass. I mean, check this out. A 4-day pass, because we're actually 4 days this year. It's $55.
Whoa.
Wow,
that's great.
You can't even buy a 1-day pass at another convention for that price.
You can't even get a 1-day pass to Disney for that.
You want to mention our contest?
Let's do that. Go ahead.
Well, we're going to have a contest.
Yay!
Yeah, we're actually giving away four-day passes for a lucky winner.
Yeah, we're going to have 2 4-day passes to give away. I just found out.
Oh, 2 now. Okay. Yeah, so you got to go onto our Instagram. It's at Metal Geeks Podcast, and you can find the image. You got to share the hell out of it. Hashtag Houston Comic Palooza and Metal Geeks Podcast. You can enter as much as you want, and the winners
will be chosen at random.
Yes, and
I love how you said Metal Geeks Podcast with a question mark at the end.
Yeah, because I have to step in here then. Well, we're going to be relaunching a site, and we've got so many different names out there right now. We got Metal Geeks, we've got Metal Geeks Podcast, The Metal Geeks, et cetera, et cetera. It's just kind of hard to keep up with it. So
it's all going to be consolidated very, very soon.
Yes. But, yeah, you just share the image, and we're going to announce the winner on May 16th.
And let's thank our other sponsor, which is thevinyldead.com, where if you use the code MetalGeeks10, you're going to save 10% off your order. And they have things from – they have a lot of Star Wars toys, Funko Pop, Mystery Minis from Funko.
Yeah, and actually, if you're a collector of figures, Funko just released a line of action figures, and they're fucking amazing. The detail on it's stellar. Right now, they launched the Game of Thrones, and if you haven't seen them, you can go to Barnes & Noble and look at them up close. Don't buy them there, but buy them on the website.
That's right. And so you can find us on all the social media, iTunes, find us there, subscribe, like us, leave a comment, and, you know, Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. And
yeah, and hopefully our new site will be launched within the next 2 weeks. We're working really hard on the back end of it. We've got an awesome artist who's been helping us out. Everybody in our Metal Geeks staff has seen some of the artwork, but I can't wait to see it completely live and, you know, not so secretive.
So definitely thank you again to Leonard and Philip for coming on and discussing their documentary and just geeking out with us in general.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
You're welcome.
I'd actually like to have you guys back on again just to geek out about stuff in general.
I'm going to be excited because I've met so many people in the last, like, 2 or 3 weeks trying to do this whole Kickstarter thing. But I've been in, you know, promo mode, and it's nice to expand the circle of friends and geeks, definitely. So, yeah, I'd love to come back and just geek out with you guys.
Yeah,
because
sure.
That's one of the things we'd love to do on the show is just we try not to, like, when we have a metal person on, we don't want to talk about their new album the whole time. We want them to be themselves and just geek out. Like, we just had Paul Kerr from a band called November's Doom talked about the album for a little bit, but then we talked about Spider-Man the rest of the time.
Nice. I mean, shit, so. We even had the guy from, was it Window to the Magic?
Yep, Paul.
He was on here.
Paul Berry.
And he didn't even really talk about the podcast as much. We just geeked out about stuff. And he was actually, he didn't have to have a muffler on because, you know, he's got the whole kid-friendly podcast going. So it's kind of nice.
That's right. He didn't have to self-censor himself at all. Fuck that.
Yeah, exactly.
So check out the Dark Side of Disney book and check out the Kickstarter. Go to Kickstarter and type in Dark Side of Disney. Once again, thank you guys. And as we say to all of our guests at the very end,
keep it geeky.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Hey, Geekazoids. Thanks for listening to another fine podcast brought to you by MSR Productions. All rights reserved, blah, 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 blah. For reviews, archives of our podcasts, and all your other metal geekery needs, please visit MSRcast.com. Keep it geeky. Keep it metal.